Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
Mitchie, how are you going?
Guten Morgen.
I'm very excited because we get to welcome back Jared.
The main man, Beaujolais.
Jared. And Jared was already on, you were already on episode 51 of our podcast.
Yep.
And how far are you guys? Are into the hundreds now?
We're into
the millions, actually, Jared.
I don't know how far away. I think the beauty of speaking to you, Jared, is that we get so much gold, and I know we got so many. We got so much feedback last time about the information you shared and how easy it was to digest that information. And so for us, it was just like a no-brainer to get you back on again as an expert, because last time you were on as officially as a client, this time you're on as an expert in your field, and we want to just dive down a little bit further down the rabbit hole and see what we can share.
As well, we also want to have a little bit of fun with the listeners and do some cool stuff, and let's poke the bear a bit and have a good chat about reality and the brain. And
I love it. Bringing it. Well, I belong to you, so you guys let me know what direction to go, and we'll just start traveling.
Well, let's do that. Okay, so I want to play a game with anybody listening a bit later on, right?
Yeah.
And it's important that anybody, as they listen, I want you to do it with us as well. So Mitch and I are going to do it as well, but it's really important that you do it properly. So you have to pause if you haven't got a piece of paper and a pen to make sure you do that properly. So I think that for anybody listening, I think they need just to be really mindful that to get the message across, they have to play the game properly, right?
Yeah, so it would be wise if you just stop this now, if you're listening to it.
Well, we're not going to do the game yet.
No, of course. But I'm saying if you can grab a piece of paper at any moment in time, and before we play the game, you're going to have to press pause, grab a piece of paper and a pen, and away you go.
And it'll be fun, because what we'll do is usually the game is a live thing with visuals, so we're going to just try and do it pure auditorily this time. Should work just fine, but
let's see
when it does work, it's just one of those powerful things.
So, you know, we went through so many cool things when we were doing the other podcast. We talked about a little bit about the equilibration process, your experience of the equilibration process. We talked about the brain getting into the editor mode, and you know how to rewire your brain in a way. We talked about not losing your old perspective, adding perspective. We talked about the whole concept of hacking consciousness, which you love as well, like that whole emergent concept, you know. And I loved that. Understanding that you aren't your story and stuff like that. So that all we went through all of that at, you know, in episode 51. What I want to cover, and I ended off that episode by saying that we really wanted to, you've spent a bit of time talking to us about teenagers and what happens in the mind and in the brain of a teenager. Yeah. Can you speak to us about that? Are you able to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So for any of your listeners who have teenagers now, they'll recognize that, they are a very unique breed.
Yes.
So it's incredibly necessary. Like I'd love to say that, oops, we figured out why teenagers are weird, therefore we don't have to deal with it anymore. But the problem is they're very weird for a very specific reason. And the only way to kind of get through that is to traverse it. If you skip that, you kind of lose what it means to be an adult. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if you want to break down the teenage brain, you've kind of got, we have three foundations that we'll piece together. So foundation one is this idea of modularity, that you don't have a brain, you've got dozens of independent brains all doing their own job up here. So if you ever played the Stroop test, or if your listeners want to just go up and look up Stroop, S-T-R-O-O-P, that's a game that you'll play, and you'll start to recognize that, no, your brain fights itself. It's not unified. It's all trying to do its own stuff. Two is then this concept of the synapses being important in the brain. So when we talk about the brain, we don't care about the cells. The cells are the cells, have a good time. It's how is your brain communicating, the synapses. That's what we care about. So that communication synaptic network, that's number two. And number three is this idea, and I think you use the term editor versus, say, predictor.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that your brain can kind of be in two modes. You've got your editing mode, where the brain is actively changing stories, rewriting stuff, versus prediction, when you're just living in your stories. The brain's like, yep, been here, done that, have a good time. So that editor mode, to understand the editor mode, that's largely driven, and we're going to simplify this, that's largely driven by your prefrontal cortex. So this big area behind your eyebrows here, and that's the bit of the brain we typically say is the human part of the brain, right? Every other animal has got brains. We're the ones that got this massive PFC, and that's the bit that allows us to edit, to change, to kind of control and organize all the other baby brains. And it largely does that by sending out one message, and that message is stop. So we think of your prefrontal cortex as an inhibitor. Your brain is kind of chugging, and the way you can control it, edit it, change it, is by shutting things down, is by this editor going, nope, 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 tweak that, nope, nope. It turns things down. It doesn't activate. It doesn't turn it on. It's an inhibitor.
Right.
So now let's put these three things
together. Just let me ask a question then. So everything is on, and it switches it all off.
Yep.
As needed.
Where we used to think it did things the opposite way around.
Yeah, we used to think this was the thing activating stuff. Hey, you want to feel this? You want to do this? What it can do is the world comes in through your senses and pretty much activates your brain. So the world is the thing that turns your brain on. You get a smell, and the smell part's like, ooh, what's this? And you see something in the sights, ooh, what's this? Now your prefrontal cortex can now feed back and say, okay, if that's the pure incoming noise, let me tweak it, turn it off, switch it to make it more aligned with me. And it does that tweaking by just shutting off individual neurons. So it's very rare. Now it can, don't get me wrong. So like right now, if you close your eyes and imagine yourself riding a horse, and if you're shirtless and your hair is blown in the wind, that's even better. So just imagine yourself doing that right now.
I'm doing this.
This is, don't stop, just let it go, let it ride. In this instance, your prefrontal cortex can activate your brain. So if I could image your brain now, it would look very similar. As you imagine yourself riding a horse, it would look very similar as it would when you were actually riding a horse. So riding a horse gives you the input, turns on your brain. When you visualize, your brain can turn things on, can mimic the input. It's just the vast majority of the time it doesn't do that. It works to shut things down. That's how it organizes.
So let me ask a question then, because I say to the clients all the time, and this is true, and spending some time with the great Paul Bailey, and he said in his book, Think of an Elephant. I don't know whether you've read that. It's amazing. He said the frontal lobe of your brain can do one of two things, either create or protect. When it's in protection mode, it can't create. When it's in creation mode, it doesn't need to protect. Is this what we're talking about?
Yeah, that sounds, if you get down to the mechanisms of that, that sounds pretty accurate.
Okay, so it's switching things off because it's trying to protect you, get you into bottom-up mode, what you're familiar with, to get you safe and to your deathbed safely.
That is awesome. Yep, it says we already understand the world, so tweak it this way.
Right.
So exactly. So you're safe. So you're just nothing. Don't worry about what's really happening. Just enjoy the way you think it should be happening.
So we use the analogy of driving a car. You're learning how to drive a car, and you have, you know, your hands on the steering wheel 10 to 2. You have to put your feet in certain spots. But it's like once you have got that, you realize that information, while it's there, you don't actually need it. You don't have to have your hands there. You can have your hand on the windowsill. You don't have to think about where everything goes exactly. You can just, it's auto, it's automatic.
And you're spot on. All that information is still coming in. Your brain is still responding to it. It's just, you're not. The editor doesn't need to actively say, oh, what is all this noise? It says, cool, stimulus, steering wheel. Oh, we know this. Just run that autopilot, and it tweaks everything to fit your driving pattern. So now you're in pure autopilot.
Yeah.
Even if the car is slightly different, it can still tweak it so you don't notice things.
Yeah.
This is why we tend not to, kind of a tangent, why we tend to miss a lot of errors we do is because we're very convinced of what we were supposed to be doing. And so even if we're not doing that, the frontal lobe's like, don't worry about it. Just, I can tweak all that incoming information to fit the way you think it should have been.
Right.
Just an easy way to kind of see that is if you're a writer, you probably notice that you'll write something good and you'll edit it and you'll reread it 3 or 4 times and you nailed it. Give that to your spouse. They read it and they're like, you have a typo in the first sentence. Something you looked at 100 times. Mm. Why didn't you see it? Because your brain knew what it should have been and it just kept paving over. It kept sending, even though the signal came in wrong, the frontal cortex could pave it back and say, don't worry about it. Here's what you meant to say. So just experience that. Enjoy it.
Right.
So it gets pretty powerful, kind of scary, but that's the good, what you were saying, protection mode. It just, The world makes sense when you're in that mode. And it's right. a lot easier than when you're in the creation mode, which right. is, let's change all this. Let's tweak all this.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So, all right. So now let's bring this back to teens. Because this is all really good. So we're talking about the power of this prefrontal cortex. So we've got our three foundations. We've got modularity, many brains. We've got the synapse. That's the important unit of measure. And you've got this editor, predictor, top-down, bottom-up kind of issue. Young kids. When young kids come into the world for the first 5 years of their life, their synapses explode. A five-year-old kid will have about 1,500 trillion synapses in their brain. That's 1.5 quadrillion.
Wow.
That's a ridiculous number. If you can go online and look up that number, like people stack pennies to show you how much that is, and people stack pairs of pants to show you, it's ridiculous how many synapses they have. Why do they have so many synapses? Because this is when the brain is figuring stuff out. When a baby comes into the world, it doesn't know any of this stuff. How does it learn? It just says pure input, pure input, pure input. And so it's got all these synapses to essentially say, everything that can get in is going to get in and it's going to get stuck.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start linking everything because I don't know what the hell is going on. So anytime I smell something, I'm going to link it to something else I'm hearing over here. And this taste, I'm going to link with that grass. Why? Because who knows? It's around age 5 that your brain starts to go, okay, we've got some patterns here. Some things are working, some things aren't. And this is when the brain starts to modularize. So you start to lose synapses to the point where as adults, we'll have anywhere from 100 to 1,000 trillion. So you can lose almost half of your synapses between the ages of 5 and say 10 to 12. But what's happening is that's when the brain modularizes. It says, cool. This bit, you take faces. I'm going to take names. I'm going to take smells. I'll take vision. I need to talk to you, but I don't need to talk to you. And the brain really starts to organize itself. So now when you get input, all the different parts of the brain go, cool, that's me. I know how to handle this information. Wonderful. Now, as you've seen up until this point, it's largely just been world driven. It's been input, input, input. But our power now as human beings is feeding back and changing that input, that I don't care about that input. I can go back and tweak that now through my prefrontal cortex. Now, just like everything else, in order for your prefrontal cortex to now start to organize all these different baby brains, it has to learn how to do its job. It doesn't know what the hell it's doing. So what tends to happen is for those first, say, 10 to 12 years of your life, while your brain is doing all this crazy stuff, whoops, sorry.
You're allowed to say shit. It's okay.
Okay. While your brain's doing all this crazy shit, your prefrontal cortex is on, but it's just kind of kicking it. It's alive. It's doing its thing. It's cool. Once you hit adolescence, teenage years, that's when the prefrontal cortex says, all right, your brain is enough organized. You have enough patterns. You get the world enough that now I've got to figure out how to let you run this machine. And boom, the number of synapses between your prefrontal cortex and the rest of your brain explodes. And this is how it learns to do its job. It just starts talking to everything. Just like the brain of a five-year-old just says, gimme, gimme, gimme. For the prefrontal cortex to learn how to run the brain, it just says, all right, I'm going to turn off everything. And I'm going to see what breaks, what bends. Does it kill you? Whoops, better not turn that off anymore. What if I turn all these things off at the same time? And it just starts shutting everything down, essentially.
Right.
So now this is a good point where you go, okay, if I have a human being and the part of the brain that shuts down the rest of the brain is going haywire and just turning everything off, what type of behaviors would you expect in a person when their brain is just being turned off, when everything is just being shut down? What kind of things would you expect?
They want to zone out, like sleep.
So retreat.
Sleep a lot, retreat, lack of communication, lack of engagement. Now, anyone with a teenager will recognize, yep, that is a massive set of behaviors in teens, is this just zombie-like behavior. What we think that is that's the prefrontal cortex learning to drive the rest of this machine. If it doesn't figure out how to do its job, you're never going to get to adulthood, and it figures it out by doing way too much and turning off way too much.
Wow. You know, to just let me ask a question, because one of the things I do whenever I meet people who have teenagers...
Yeah.
I will say to them, especially if it's girls, because I got two up-and-coming teenage girls, I'll say to them, okay, at what point, at what point did they get crazy? At what point did they, and they all say the same thing. At around about 11 till around about 13, then from around about, then they go good for about a year, and between 13 and 14, and then about 14 they retreat, and then they come out of themselves at about 16, and then they come out of the bedroom. And I'd be like, so how did you handle that? And every one of them says, at first, it's like the brain sets the environment to say, don't test me, let it go. So the first spell, I had to learn to just let it happen. Just let it happen. Don't take it personally. Understand this is just the process of what they're doing. And then it's like the first spell was to set you up as a parent. This is the feedback I get. The second spell seems to be when most of whatever happens is happening within the brain. I mean, is that sound correct?
I would love to see, because you can assume this process of frontal lobe kind of activation is usually or around the time of menses in young girls. So puberty onset. Yeah. So you can assume it's going to be right around age 12 when that kicks off, 11 through 13 in Western countries, which is, that would when you, the first chunk when you'd see this surge of what the heck is going on. Mm. I can see them. I love it because most boys won't come back, but it's interesting to see that teenage girls might swing back for a little bit before losing themselves completely in this. And I'm not 100% sure what that would be, but I'd love to
find out what that is.
We talk very frequently about women being slightly more mature, just a little bit more mature.
More than slightly, probably.
More or less.
I don't think the research is in.
We're going to get people back in the lab. Crunch those numbers again.
We need to know.
It seems to be largely during this puberty time when girls, and we don't think it's a brain development thing in terms of, their brain moved faster.
Right.
We think it's a compensation thing where because, and this is, could be right or wrong, this is just a working theory. Because young boys are naughty and crazy, blah, once they hit teenagehood, they're so used to that for 10 years and the parents are used to it and the world has been telling them, you're a boy, you're crazy, that they just kind of let themselves into it. Whereas girls are the beautiful, quiet, kind ones from birth to 10. So when they hit this thing where now they lose somewhat control, they have this compensation method where they can pull it back and still kind of live the show that they were supposed to always live. But we don't think that's a brain thing. We think that's them fighting a sociological input and them kind of trying to live up to a standard.
Wow.
Which at a certain point will probably just get too far out of line and then they're going to go into that crazy team.
So let me ask another question then. In terms of boys, right?
Yeah.
And then in terms of things like, what about when crimes are committed? You know, what about when crimes are committed, between the age of 11 and 15 or 16? Isn't there an argument there to say, actually, this child's brain hadn't developed to understand the ramifications of the behavior? And I wonder how that would go in a court of law, you know? Because there has to be an argument that goes, hey, listen, they just didn't know. Like, it just didn't register, you know?
It's a slippery slope once you get on that track, but you can assume this is why most court judicial systems will deal with pre-18 differently. They'll say you're a juvenile, you're in your own court, and if you commit a crime pre-18, that can be expunged from your record once you hit 18 and now you're an adult, let's start again.
Right.
So a lot of courts have thought about this issue. The trick with that issue is, and I fully believe it. Look, if a 12-year-old steals something, they have to. That's part of the job of this prefrontal cortex. So think about it, let's go back for a second. This prefrontal cortex blast, which shuts everything down, that's how you learn to break the system. That's how you learn to control it. That's how you learn to own it. So that as adults, what we can do is we can sit in this sweet spot where we can either let the world drive us or we can choose to say, nope, I'm going to step up and I'm going to change it myself.
Right.
That power comes from birth through 10. We learn about the world during adolescence. That's where we learn to drive the machine.
Right. If you
circumvent that. So one of the ways, and largely the way the brain learns to drive itself, is to just break everything it can. So for me growing up, stealing was one of those immoral things. You were just taught you do not steal, which is an absolute guarantee that at some point during adolescence, I'm going to have to break that and figure out where's the edges. So I remember I'm sitting in a principal's office. They had a big thing of water bottles in the corner. Mm. Never stolen a thing in my life. And I'm just sitting there and no one is around. I'm like, screw it.
Go and get me one of those water bottles.
I'll give you a water bottle. And it's such a nothing moment. But in the scheme of things at that time, that was the moment when I figured out that program. And now I get to make a choice. Okay, mm-hmm. The world doesn't end when I break what I was taught. So do I want to continue adhering to that or not? And in which case now it's no longer a my parents told me. It's a I choose not to steal because I've lived both sides and I recognize, yep, it is up to mm-hmm. me.
Yeah.
So it's the same if you have a if you grow up super religious, your kid will go through a phase of atheism. Why? Right. Because they have to. It doesn't mean that they will never believe like you again. It's that in order to reach adulthood, they have to learn that all of those things are under their control.
So the breaking of the boundaries or the rules is an imperative part of being a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
That
is, it sucks. Like it's really bad when it comes to personal things, but when you kind of step away from it and you see it in other cognitive realms, it makes a lot more sense. So think about language. Language is something nobody really cares about. So what happens is teenagers, every group of teenagers breaks language. They come up with their own slang, their own way of spelling, their own way of doing things, emoticons instead of words. And the generation before them hates that. I hate emoticons, but I guarantee you my parents hated when I said rad, and their parents hated when they said, what do hippies say?
Dude. I'm the
chill
dude.
Chill out, bro. But no one takes any of this personally, so we're just like, that's teenagers being teenagers. There we recognize, yep, what they're doing is they're breaking language so they can learn to own that when they're older. If they're not breaking language, I'd be very afraid about their writing skills as they get older. It's what they have to do.
Right.
So we see it with language. We see it with math. We see it with these piddly things. And everyone's like, cool. But as soon as it's something personal, I'm a parent and you're going to rebel against me. No, sir. That's where we kind of get this clash. And we have to recognize it's all part of the same exact system, the same progress.
Right. Wow. As a parent, hearing that just brings so much relief. Do you know what I mean? Because you really stop and think, oh, so it wasn't my bad parenting then. No. I didn't. No. So it wasn't that I was a shit father.
I think that a lot of people like pride themselves on the behavior of their kids and they think that is the determining factor of whether they're a good parent or not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think so many people.
So the whole thing of I blame the parents. Johnny's a little shit. I blame the parents.
Well, it's not even just that. I think there's levels of it. I think there's definitely levels of when you see parents that you know that really don't have any. You can see that they're just letting the kids go wild for the sake of it. You can see that there's no boundaries, and it's a parental self-worth thing that they don't know how to deal with the child, you know. So I get that part of it. But there is another part of it that, especially in teenage years, you know, I remember when I was teaching, I remember especially loving the kids that would challenge me and that would find a way to challenge me in a way that was within, you know, I suppose respectfully is a good way to put it. But what I mean is that they found they were challenging, they were pushing the boundaries, they were edging towards the edge of what was right or wrong in that scenario, especially in a classroom scenario. But those kids that did that, I loved that about them. I loved the fact that they had that spark about them, that they, like I think so many, back when I was, this is my reflection back when I was teaching, that there were so many parents that really wanted to dim that spark and dim that extra that, you know, the teenagers had. And I'd be like, no, that's what makes them unique that's what they have to go through. That teenager has to push the boundaries and rebel a little bit in order to evolve from that or emerge from that.
And they'll screw up. Your spot is they'll push and you'll love it. And every once in a while, even the best ones will push too far. They'll break.
Yeah, of course.
And you go, ooh, no. And they need to know that. And that's you'll see it even in their eyes when they go, ooh. And they know, I just pushed a little too far, didn't I? But that's how if they never got to that stage where they broke something too much, they'd never know where the edges are. So in a very odd sense, if your students, in your case, so I'm a teacher, so that's where I talk about, but let's go back. If your children rebel against you, feel confident enough to push back against you, that is a pretty damn good sign that they feel safe around you, which means that's a good sign of love.
Yeah.
Right.
I hate to say it, but the more a kid is willing to rebel and push back against their parents, that's not a sign of anger. That's a sign that, cool, you did something right before this, the teenage years, that they feel safe enough to push you.
Yeah, and safe enough to feel like, yeah, safe in that space that they can push against you. If I can do it with my dad or my mum, then, yeah.
And that's, I better do it with my dad than someone I don't know or my principal or someone that I don't know what the consequences are going to be. Mm. I push against my parents because I know they love me and I love them so much that I'm not going to die from this. Mm-hmm. So as it's kind of an aside, that there are the teenagers who do not feel, and you see this in Hollywood and in books all the time, the teenagers who do not feel safe enough to rebel against their parents, they rebel elsewhere, usually in much worse ways. But at some point in their life, they're going to crack. And the reason they couldn't rebel against their parents is because they didn't feel the love. They didn't feel the safety enough to do that.
Mm. So the environment wasn't there to be able to allow them to do it. So I remember watching a documentary not so long ago on Gaia, which I love Gaia, where he was talking about we seem to forget things, right? And we alter memories. And he was talking about that there's a chemical in the brain that has this amnesia. So we forget the source of what we come from and where we come from. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know what the chemical would be.
Yeah.
But I think if it had
like a PF451 or something, it was something crazy like that. And they were saying, like, I swear to God. And if I have to look for it for this year's STP, but if in finding it, I'll send it over to you and what the guy was talking about. But it was pretty cool because he was talking about, and there was the conversation was around the development of the frontal lobe of the brain, how it happened, and then he was talking about the fact that this seems to be, it's like, not man-made, but it was deliberately done. And they were trying to say it happened over 200,000 years ago, blah, 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 blah. They were talking about the missing gap of 200,000 to 2 million years, man, apes standing upright, why we stood upright, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But I'll send over some of the data to you. I just wanted to see.
Is he talking, going all the way back to source, say, pre-birth source? Or is he talking sources in why we forget the first, say, 5 years of life?
Pre-birth source and why, and also why we forget things and what is it that actually makes us forget? Why are we, you can remember the first time you ever kissed your missus, but you can't remember what you had for breakfast last Wednesday. So that sort of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Don't tell her that.
Yeah. No.
But I do remember what I had for breakfast. It was delicious. But no, it's interesting. I wouldn't know about going all the way back, say pre-birth, although there's so much interesting stuff to show that it's not an instantaneous thing, that young kids display memories and behavioral patterns that are very strange if there wasn't some memory of something else.
Right.
And this is like, and people have heard the stories about young kids who can say, ooh, when they're driving over a bridge, they go, hey, I died on this bridge.
Yeah.
And the parents are like, the hell? And usually they write it off. But there's enough of these examples to show that
there's something.
If there is a chemical that shuts that down, it's not an immediate chemical.
Yeah.
So if it is linked to the prefrontal cortex, you could assume it starts to really tack on. Mm-hmm. It would be after 10, but you could assume between 5 and 10 when you get that synaptic pruning that the brain starts to kick in and say, okay.
But have you ever had an interest in how that prefrontal cortex developed? Like when it developed? There's so many different hypotheses about it, but when it came about? Because, it's obviously what separates us.
Yeah. Mm. What was the driving thing? Who was there's a ton of theories on it. I've not got tucked into it myself.
Well, they're talking about the altering of the second genome. That's what was responsible. And who was it? Not Joe Dispenza, not Bruce Lipton. Greg Braden. And I watched him talk live about it a few times, and it was very interesting. And he was saying, it seems that when they discovered how to splice a genome, they also discovered that the second genome in the human beings had been deliberately spliced. So I'm on stage going, did you just say the second genome in a human being?
We have two genomes.
What did you just say? But yeah, he said.
What did he say? That we've got two different genomes.
The second genome is split, honestly burnt on the hill for this. The second genome was split, and it was deliberately split. And the way they worked it out was because they worked out how to split a genome.
And once they did it, they look back and they go, "Ooh, there's all the telltale signs."
Yes, and then they said it happened about 200,000 years ago.
Jeez.
So now you have to understand, these are guys that advise the UN.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you're hearing him saying that, like, I was like, no, 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 no. You can't just say that. Like, that just has, what is that, has so many different connotations. It's so many different, that's a rabbit hole in itself.
Yeah.
What are you saying exactly? And the conversation was very interesting with him in the end.
You got to love it. At the end of the day, all the stuff we know, we don't know. And when, the way science progresses is you have your spotlight, and you just start collecting information. And if information falls within the spotlight, good, you use it. If it falls outside of the spotlight, you just pretty much ignore it. You know it's there, but you're like, screw it, whatever. Until, and this is what Popper says, until the amount of information outside of your spotlight exceeds the amount inside. At that point, you have a paradigm shift, the spotlight shifts, and now you can deal with different information. That seems to be exact. We have so many facts and ideas and things that we know just don't fit our current theory.
Yeah.
And so they're just collecting out here. Like, hey, we have a second genome, maybe it was spliced, but what do? We just go, no, 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 no.
Yeah.
We still have enough in our light to deal with, so we're just gonna talk here, but I promise you there will be a shift. It's gonna be within our lifetime where the whole story just goes wharm.
Yeah.
And it's almost that people don't recognize when Einstein says it's relativity, that throws 400 years of research, not away, but just totally changes all of that. Mm-hmm. Newton was wrong.
Yeah.
It wasn't that he was stupid. It wasn't that he was silly. It was that he was wrong.
Yeah.
And that's cataclysmic to people, especially in physics. It's such a massive shift. That's what's going to happen with biology, with the brain, and with genetics as well. Something is going to crack in our lifetime. We're going to say,
but
that
don't they,
entire
I mean,
story
they,
was just
Don't they
wrong.
Just adapt the information, you know, to fit their model.
That's what he's saying. That's what the, I mean, anything outside of everything, the spotlight, they ignore.
Or if it becomes fact, they adapt their light to go, oh, okay, so yeah. So we've just worked this out.
It's always been, and that's all we do. And then if you want to extend it, and this is goes pretty far, but if you want to extend it, question, do you believe science will ever end? Some people will answer yes to that question, in which case this moving spotlight is us refining our understanding. Far more people will answer, no, science will never end. It's a non-ending thing. Anytime I get an answer, I'm not closer. I now have five more questions that I didn't even knew existed before.
Yeah.
So science isn't an end. It's just a trajectory. It's just a journey that we keep going on. So if science doesn't end, then every time you move a spotlight, you're not getting any closer to an answer. You're simply changing the answer, and it will change again, and it will change again, and 20 years or 200 years from now, it's going to change again.
Yeah.
And anyone who's got a spotlight now will say, we have the claim on truth, because we do in this moment.
Yeah, doesn't mean,
but in 100 years, they'll laugh at us the same as we're laughing at people 100 years ago. It will never stop. So 20,000 years, they're going to keep moving the damn spotlight, and no one will ever be closer. We're just making up stuff as we go along. What's relevant?
So I know we've gone off track a little bit from the kids thing, which is fine, but I just want to go back to that because I want to finish off on that topic, and I want to ask a quick question about that before we move on. Is, you know, I think you told a story one time of a kid who didn't have any of those experiences and didn't get a chance to rebel. What would happen to a kid who doesn't get a chance to rebel or doesn't push the boundaries or you know, test the waters at all? Like, what happens to a kid like that?
So what you tend to see is either they'll deeply internalize all of that stuff, and so all of the rebelling just becomes internal, and these are the kids that are just simmering away and everything looks fine, but you know something is really wrong on the inside. Or they'll hit the rebellion stage later. So like, my brother never got to rebel against my parents ever, just because of the way we grew up. So when I'm a teenager and I'm just being an ass to them left and right, he never was. And you could just tell it was, and I just kept saying, just give him time. And by the time he hits about 22 and he graduates from college, that's when he hits rebel.
Wow.
And then he just starts exploding at them. And everyone's like, whoa, you're an adult. Why are you doing this? It's because he never got to figure out how to run that aspect of his life. Could you go your whole life without ever breaking something? I'm sure it's possible, But for the most part, if it's a deep enough system and family is going to be one of them, you're going to, you have to rebel against it. So if it doesn't happen during the teenage years, it could happen when they're in their 30s. And that could be one of the worst things that happens to them, because now you've got a 30-year-old who's trying to create a family of their own or a career. And that triggers a reminder that, oh, I never really solved the issues with my dad and my mom. So what do? They turn into a teenager around their family and do weird stuff and just become really mean, nasty people.
You're right.
And that's them going through that. And no one can recognize it, but it's really just because I never got to do this before. I have to do it at some point to see where this all plays.
Yeah. So it's like you're just trying to exercise that muscle. You're trying to work out how does this work.
If you don't break language, you're going to write the same as everyone else, but you're never really going to own that. You're never going to have a voice in your writing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Even if you want to write like Emily Dickinson, you can imitate it, but until you break it and then rebuild it yourself, you don't know. So this is why I love Picasso. Picasso, go back and look at his paintings. The reason he was who he is because he broke every style of painting he could. He didn't just imitate. He imitated to the point of perfection, and then he figured out how to break all of them. So he was a master at cubism, at expressionism, at synthetic cubism, at neorealism, you name it, he nailed it. And what does he come up with? He comes up with drawing like a kid. When he's 80 years old, he realizes, okay, now that I get all of these things, I don't have to imitate, I can do my own stuff with all this. He ends up painting like a little 10-year-old kid.
Wow.
But we don't make the mistake. We all know that that's deep. It's not, we don't mistake it for a 10-year-old kid, but that was his final hoorah with all this. So if you don't break things, you never learn how to own them and then internalize them and say, this is what this means for me. Here's how I want to use this information. Right.
Yeah.
It's, I don't want to harp on it, but I'll, because we still have, there's one other aspect, and I guarantee you some of the listeners will be like, well, wait a second, what about the crazy kids, the risk takers, all that stuff? So the prefrontal cortex shuts down your brain. That's where we get our zombie behaviors. Mm-hmm. Where the risk taking and all that other stuff comes from is to counteract that prefrontal cortex. Because in all of her wisdom, Mother Nature realized, wait a second, if I've got an entire generation of people just shutting off their brain for 6, 7, 8 years at a time, they're going to die. You're not going to survive 8 years of just zombie-like behavior. Mm. And just go back in the past. A bear comes and attacks us. Parents are running. Kids are running. Teenagers are the ones that are going, they're going to die. So we got to wake them up somehow. So to counteract that prefrontal cortex to keep teenagers alive, a small part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens actually grows in size, which is very rare neurologically speaking, but this is one of those rare moments where a part of your brain will physically change its size and it gets bigger. This is essentially your pleasure center. So to counteract the prefrontal cortex shutting things down, the pleasure center ramps up and says, yeah, but things feel real good,
that's
don't
right
they?
Yeah.
And so this is where in teenagers, like as adults, if we think of emotions on a scale of, we'll say 0 is neutral, +5 is the craziest you've ever been, -5 is depression. As adults, we live around 0. We just hover. If we have a good day, it's 1, maybe 2, and then we're back. And then, oh, I got in a fight with my wife, that's -1. Teenagers, emotions at 1, -1, 2, -2, they're not powerful enough to push through the prefrontal cortex,
right.
So they would never experience them. For them, feelings are +5, -5, +5, -5, +5. That enhanced feeling sensation is what drives them to push past this zombie-like behavior.
Right.
So it keeps them alive. But on the other hand, once you get all this crazy behavior, that's where you get the risk-taking and the drug exploration and the promiscuity and the sensations that I'm invincible. The best way to see it is just with consequences. And we always say teenagers forget consequences. No, because of the nucleus accumbens push, it's not that they forget them. They just don't give a shit.
Right.
A 6-year-old knows it's bad. A 60-year-old knows it's bad. A 16-year-old, you better believe, knows it's bad. It's just they think they're invincible. They don't feel, they feel so strongly or negatively about it that they feel invincible. They're powerful. They can get through anything. Yeah, you'll die if you text and drive, but not me because I can do anything. So that's where this thing which keeps them driven is also because of that, as a kind of secondary. That's where we get all this risk-taking kind of attitudes and that other behavior from teenagers of just them acting like absolute nuts.
Because I can so relate to that. Like, I can so relate. Do you remember it for you?
As I get older, I'm forgetting it more and more. I remembered it, but now as I get older, I'm like, I couldn't have done that, I did it.
Yeah, I mean, we'll be out on the bikes with the lads, and I think you'll hear them saying, you know, when I was a nipper, I wouldn't give a shit about doing this, you know? But I also see, like I see in some of the guys that I go out with now that are just learning, started riding about a year ago, that are now doing some crazy shit, you know? And they've gone from being asleep and dormant and overweight and beer drinking to joining up with a bike gang. And now, on, you know, and when I say a bike gang.
We're push bikes.
And sorry, I don't mean they've become coffin cheaters or gypsy jokers or anything like that. I mean, so they're out on these mountain bikes doing crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So that you think that takes a lot of nuts to do that, holy. And you know what I mean? It's like, so they've gone from.
They're finally waking up after so long of dormancy.
I wonder what is happening in the brain when that's happening. You know, that when you're throwing, you're throwing a caution to the wind and you're just doing stuff that could seriously hurt you, like seriously, seriously hurt you, and you just do it anyway. And you're 47 years old, 50 years old.
There's great researchers doing work with extreme sports, and they're finding that it's essentially, a lot of people can get into that flow state. So you know that state of flow. Yeah. When, if they're trying something brand new and they're doing that daring, they tend to go into a flow state, which means, for the most part, your prefrontal cortex, that controller, is essentially dormant. Right. During those times, you're not trying to control. You're not trying to judge. You're just living.
Yeah.
Right. And so that might be why they get away. But I'd also see if there wouldn't be a switch. If like the first time you try anything, you kind of push +2, +3, +4. Oh my gosh, this is great. I haven't ridden a bike since I was 10. I haven't done anything fun since I was 10. I'm doing something fun. This feels great. And when you feel that great, you're a teenager again, you feel that invincibility.
Right.
And so maybe they're, but then give them a couple months of that when it wears off and it's like bike riding is just more normal.
Yeah.
If they don't come back and go, damn, that's kind of dangerous. I might not try that.
Yeah.
Right. Might not do that one again.
Right.
But you're right. I'm kind of thinking back to my teenage years. Yeah. We used to, there's so much my nephews do that I just look at them like, are you kidding me? And then my brother will say, we used to do handstands on the roof. I'm like, no, we didn't.
Yeah.
I couldn't even do a handstand on a damn floor now without getting too scared. I'm going to break my neck.
Yeah,
I can't believe we would have done that. But lo and behold, we used to do that crap. Yeah. So that's that nucleus accumbens saying, so you don't just zombie out and die. Let's pump this up.
Well, cool.
Do you reckon there's a reason we forget as adults about that?
It's the memory issue. So in the last episode or series, we're talking about how our stories can drive our perceptions.
Yeah.
What happens is that's also retroactive in that your stories can change your memories as well. So we like to think that our memories are clean, but they're not. They're constantly changing to reflect our new understanding that's of right. the world. So you can assume as you get older and your story changes and you have kids and everything about your understanding about the world changes, you rewrite your childhood, your high school memories to match kind of your new story. And it's like, yes, I was crazy, but I was never that crazy.
So
because I would never do that.
This might be a good time to play that little game, hey?
Yeah.
Can we do that? Because I haven't played it in a while. So I'm going to go ahead and play it. I'm going to write it down, the answers. Well, I'm not going to write it down. I have to listen first, and I'll let you run it. And anybody listening has to obviously do the game properly, otherwise it's not going to actually work, right?
All right.
So you've got to actually do it properly. Right.
So here's what we're going to do. So we're going to play a quick memory game. So here's how this game's going to work. We're only going to do one list because with audio it just makes it a little easier. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you out a list of words. All you have to do is sit and listen to that list of words. And when I'm done reading it, I'm going to give you about 20 seconds. I want you to spend that 20 seconds writing down as many words as you can remember from that list in any order that you want.
Okay.
So again, while I'm saying it, you're just sitting, listening, trying to memorize. And when I'm done, you've got 20 seconds to write down as many words as you can remember in any order that you want. So here we go. Here is our list of words. Hard, light, pillow, plush, loud, cotton, fur, touch, fluffy, feather, furry, downy, kitten, skin, tender. All right, over to you, 20 seconds, as many words as you can remember. So now here's what we're going to do. If you've got your list, all I want you to do is fold it up, flip it over, get it out of your mind. I don't want you looking at your list. Put it away somewhere. What we're going to do is we're just going to change gears real fast. I promise you we'll come back to this in a second. But so we're going to be talking about memory here. What's that?
He's just remembered another word he's writing down. Go.
You cheater. You son of a. So here's what we got. We're talking memory. Now, memory, when it comes to recalling, bringing up a memory, we were just talking about this idea that it's kind of malleable. So it's very hard for us to accurately bring back memories, but we kind of have two flavors then what we talk about is sometimes you recall a memory and you absolutely remember it. So this is when you absolutely know beyond a shadow of a doubt that it happened. Like I remember eating a salad for lunch an hour ago. I can replay it in my mind. I'm living it right now. Boom. The other flavor is when you just kind of know something happened. Like this is when you start bringing it online, but it's almost like that tip of the tongue. Like you can't really place yourself back. You know it's right, but you can't really relive it. So like I know last week I would have eaten Wheat Bix for breakfast in the morning just because I know but I can't relive it. Like I know it's a thing, but I can't actually relive it. So you've got remember, that's when you can absolutely boom, there's no question about it. Then you've got know, where it just feels right. So keeping that in mind, I want to go back to our game now. So don't look at your list, keep your list away, keep those things hidden. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to say a word. What I want you to do is to yourself and you guys, since you're live, you can play with us. Your job is to answer yes or no, that word was or it wasn't on the list we just heard. And if it was, do you remember it or do you just kind of know? So do you have like a deep memory for it or do you just kind of feels right? So here we go. So let's just pick our first word here. We're going to say is hard. So hard.
Yes.
Was it on the list?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you remember this word or do you just kind of know that?
Remember it.
I remember it.
Boom. All right. So perfect. And I'm guessing most of the listeners are exactly the same. Why the heck do we remember that word? So what was unique
was
about
the first
that
one.
Word? So first word. So we call this the primacy effect. That list started with the word hard. When it comes time to learn something to build a memory, what we tend to do is we tend to anchor on the very first thing out of the gate. Primacy effect. This is why action movies start with like a big set piece, woo, that has nothing to do with the rest of the film because they know you're going to remember this. So let's hold on to it.
Mm-hmm.
So primacy effect. All right, let's go and do another word. Our next word then is going to be tender. Tender. Do we think tender was on our
yes.
list?
Yes.
Yes.
And do we remember it or just kind of know that it was?
Remember.
Why do we remember that one?
Well, I remember it because it was the last word.
Bingo. So primacy effect, we tend to remember and anchor on the first thing out of the gate. Recency effect, we also tend to remember and anchor on the last thing out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
How things start and finish is all important for how we start to construct and understand our memories.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's bring it into a third word. Let me just pull it up. So we've got soft. So soft, yes or no, it was on our list or it wasn't?
I think it was.
I think no.
Okay, so we got a mix. So Mitch, do you remember or do you just kind of know?
I kind of know.
Okay.
But a part of me's also gone fluffy. I know he said fluffy.
So here we go.
It's fluffy the same as soft.
I'm just thinking about my rabbit fluffy.
So my guess is a lot of the listeners will kind of be sitting where you're sitting. Some of them will be saying yes, and some of them will be saying they remember. I absolutely did not say the word soft. That word never, ever.
Damn you. But so you said words around it.
Yes, he said soft things.
So you got it. So I start the word with hard.
I've got Tasha. Did you say soft? You heard it soft. Okay.
Yes. If you haven't played this before, most people will go, yep, soft. I remember that.
Did you say fluffy?
I did say fluffy. That was on there. You'll never forget fluffy. But here's what just happened.
Snorted.
You've got, I start the word with hard, I end with tender. I know you're going to remember these words.
Right.
So what am I activating? What concept do hard and tender have in common?
Well
they're
first,
hard and soft.
Oh, they're opposites.
Left and right.
They just have to do with touch.
Touch, yeah.
So we're
yeah.
talking about sensation of touch. And then what did I fill the middle of the list with?
You filled it with all fluffy, soft things.
Fluffy. Kitten
and fluffy and light.
Yeah. Woo! Feather. And so I never said the word soft. But what happens is because I'm activating a concept and talk around that word, most people out there not only thought I said soft, a lot of you will remember me having said soft. And these two stuttered and were like, we're not sure. You were at home going, of course he said it. No, I didn't.
Wow.
That is a false memory. And that's how easy these things are. So we're back now to this concept of we like to think that memory is clean. It's not. Anytime you're bringing in new information, as we learned last time, you're filtering that through your current story, your current understanding of the world. Mm. And that's how you start to lay down your initial memory. So even though I never demonstrably, you can rewind it all you want, never said a word that you remember me saying, that's because you just created a false memory. Now, the problem with this, or not the problem, but the extension of this is the way memory works is every time you access a memory, bring it out of your brain. We don't know where they go, but you bring it out of your brain, you bring it up into your working memory, and you start thinking about it. So right now, think about what you had for dinner yesterday. As you're thinking about it, that is no longer in your brain proper. It's now in your prefrontal cortex, and it's only here. The joke is every time you recall a memory, you can do whatever you want to it. You can change it. You can tweak it. You can add something to it. You can take something out of it. You can cut little bits away from it, merge it with something else. You can do all you want. And when you're done thinking about it, boom, now you have to restore it back in your brain. And when it goes back different. Anytime you recall a memory, it is out of your brain. It's in your working memory and you have to put it back. And when you put it back, the old memory is dead and whatever's there, that's all you've got.
Wow.
And so what starts to happen is, and you can start, I think the scariest example of this for me, well, you recognize this, like if you've ever had that fight with a loved one where you're like, you said this, no, you said this, no, why would I say this? I said this, no, you wouldn't, you said this. In that instance, you're both right. You've simply changed your memories to match what you think should have happened. And right. You fully both believe yeah. what you're saying. One of you isn't lying to the other. It's you've changed your memories. So we used to think that this was kind of like a cutesy thing, like kind of just fun and neat. But one of the scariest, this is my least favorite thing ever done in psych, was right after 9/11. So 9/11 happens and we all remember where we were on 9/11. That's one of those moments in the world we call a flashbulb moment where you build a deep memory for that moment. Right after it happened, a researcher in New York had a bunch of his friends write their 9/11 stories out. He was gonna compile a book, that was gonna be his contribution. So he just has these 100 stories of people saying, here's where I was, here's what I was thinking, cool. Never gets around to publishing the book. So what happens is 5 years later, he's like, dang, I should probably go back to that project. So he goes back to his 100 friends and says, hey, will you guys rewrite your stories for me? Yeah, fine. So they rewrite their stories. He gets them, compares them to the original stories. 80% of them were massively different.
Wow.
Like not even in the ballpark. Like one of the people who right after 9/11 said they were watching it on TV started talking about how they were at ground zero when it was happening. One person talked about running into the building, which we know nobody did. So he goes back to all these people. He's like, so what happened here? You have this story you wrote right after the event. You have this story 5 years later. They're totally different. Which one is right? To a man, all of them said, it's the one I just wrote. The one I wrote 5 years ago, right after the event, I must've been stressed. I wasn't in my right mind. What I wrote to you yesterday, that's the true story. And no, it wasn't. That's their true memory for it now. That's what they've changed their memory to. In the 5 years in between the event and now, they saw so many news stories and they would add that to their memory, or they heard about something and they would add that to their memory.
They keep accessing it, and every time they access it, they change it with whatever's going on.
Boom.
Store it again.
Different.
Yeah, right.
And so there's our teenager problem, is when you start to recognize that not only do stories drive your perception, stories drive your past. And why can't I remember what it's like to be a teenager? Because I've changed my memories of being a teenager to match my current understanding of the world, to the point where no, I would never have been crazy. You certainly were. You've just changed so much shite between now and then. And this gets really trippy when you start to think about things like trauma. And this is one of the big, I don't want to say issues, but one of the big kind of theories underlying trauma is an event happens and it's bad. Cool. We all go through it. What some people do is the next day, so let's say today you get in a car wreck and you have a ham sandwich. Tomorrow, which of those events are you more likely to recall to bring up to mind?
The car wreck.
So the ham sandwich just disappears. I'm thinking about my car wreck. Now you've already told yourself a story about this. That car wreck was bad. So let's say you pull up that memory and let's say it's like 50% bad. You remember it should be bad. So what do? You just color it a little worse. You're like, wait, it should be bad. Why don't I feel as bad? Let me just, oh, you put it back, now it's 51% bad. Mm-hmm. Recall it the next day and you're like, man, that should be bad. You add a little more to it, you put it back, now it's 53% bad. Mm-hmm. You keep cycling this memory retrieval and coloring it worse to the point where you now have a traumatic 100% bad memory that you can't get over, that is controlling your life. Mm-hmm. When if we could rewind the clock, it's demonstrably false, A, and the process to make it traumatic wasn't the event itself, it was your coloring of it as we moved, as we kept recalling mm-hmm. in the intervening years. In a real sense, this is us driving our own trauma, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Works the other way around, where you drive your own strength off the back end of that trauma, but this is where now psychology and stuff, a lot of therapies, their entire process is this, is access a memory, tweak it, and we're gonna put it back different. Mm-hmm. Access your trauma. You can't get over a fear or a trauma without explicitly kind of trying to deal with it, at least therapeutically. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are other ways maybe we can do it, but in a therapy session, you have to confront it. And what do? Is we talk about it and we tweak it. And we say, okay, was it really that bad? What else can we see in there? You try and change it a little bit, put it back, come back next week, do it again till we start to strip that story away and replace a new understanding. Mm-hmm.
Because the other thing is that memory gives people an identity, you know? Yep. So when you, what I find even when we're working with people is that you're fighting their memory, so you're fighting their identity. And if you fight their identity, they feel attached to that. And if they feel attached to that, then they feel, fuck, if I'm not this, then what am I? So it's some, for some people, when you're working with them, it's kind of like they're fighting for their life because they yep. think they are that memory.
Yeah.
You know, they really...
There's a big... Once you start taking this to its conclusion, you start to recognize there's a lot of scariness around here, but that's, there's huge philosophers who said your entire identity is your memory. That it's, yeah. it's, this isn't a new thing. This is all we have is our
yeah.
memory.
Yeah.
The idea being then sci-fi says, well, can, if I change your memory, would you even know that the world had changed? And the answer is no, you'd still believe in your pure identity, even though all this changed, because your identity is your memory. And then once you extend Ooh. That and realize that, no, it's always changing, then you start to see how big of a role you play in your own identity. Mm. If you change your identity today, you change your memory for yesterday, and it's going to start aligning. But it's almost back to that science spotlight thing we were talking about, where you yeah. just fit things to your current paradigm. Mm. And that's how we then build our identity. Mm. So once you, I'd love to say that once you start to recognize these patterns, you can play with them a little bit more. Like once you recognize your identity isn't your memory, your identity is whatever the heck you want it to be right now, today, that empowers you. But you're absolutely right. It's, I've known this forever and it still scares the living shit out of me.
Yeah.
It's a very frightening concept mm. to yeah. recognize that. No, mm. I'm just building day by day by day. Mm.
Mm. We're dealing, I mean, this is what we deal with our clients, you know, we're dealing with people who have these perceptions of what's happened to them. And, you know, what we're working through is finding the truth in that and accessing yeah. the whole, all of it, not just looking at it from one side, looking at it from the other side. And like you said, the previous time is when you can do that, instead of seeing the coin from the head side or from the tail side, you look above the coin and you can see the whole thing. Yeah. And that's the beauty, I suppose, in working on yourself. And what we do is that we give people, at the end of the day, you're always going to be perceiving things through a lens, whether yeah. the spotlight's here or whether it's here, it's always going to be a lens. But what we're working on is enlarging our perspective so that we can take in more and more and more with the lens that yeah. we see the world.
The one thing that has been common with everybody, excuse me, the one thing that's been common with everybody is that every single one of them, every single person I've ever worked with has had an innate knowing that they're not their memory.
Yeah.
And because of that, and when you get them to lean into that, which is what we do, we get them to lean into it, then they are able to get perspective, so step outside, look in, not be it anymore, and then that's when they change. You know, that's when, it's like when you put enough pressure on the story, there comes a point where they're like, okay, I'm willing to let go of this story because the pressure of holding on to it is too great, and it's easier for me to actually stop and move.
Mm. And you've got to get through that crunch. Yeah. And how many people, if you're not dedicated, if you're not focused, you start feeling that crunch and your initial reaction is just step away
yeah.
from that.
Oh, yeah.
That hurts. That's scary. Yeah. I'm out.
Yeah.
And this, and I think one of the big things that I love that you always talk about, that it's so disarmingly simple, yet the more you think about it, the crazier it gets, is this idea that everything in the universe is a polarity. It, nothing exists without polarity.
Mm-hmm.
Every plus has a minus. Every uphill is a downhill. Every tall is a small. Nothing exists without something to bounce it against.
Mm-hmm.
Easiest way to see it is, and it's just as simple as, you get your three tubs of water, a cold one, a warm one, and a hot one. Put one hand in the cold, one in the hot, sit in there for a minute, then dip them both in the warm simultaneously, and you'll see the warm, the one that was in the cold feels hot, the one that was in the hot now feels cold. The warm wasn't there. The warm isn't a thing. It's just a comparator. So everything has to bounce off of everything else. And this means, this is what reframing is in psychology. Every good event in your life will come with its negatives. It couldn't have existed without it. Every negative event in your life will come with its positives. It literally could not have come into existence without that. Anything that doesn't have a polarity is considered essentially antimatter, and it self-annihilates immediately as it occurs. It does not exist. And it's such a simple, it's like from physics, you just go, yeah, well, of course, that's a truism. But it's one of those things that at least once a week, I'll just be sitting in the shower and that will pop back into my head. And I'll be like, damn, that just gets deeper and deeper. It's such a simple little thing that the more you kind of play with it, it's like,
100%.
That goes far. And it starts to explain a lot. And that's why, like, when you get that bigger perspective, the idea is you can see both polarities. It's not that one is wrong or right. It's not that you get rid of one to hold on to another. It's all there. And the more you can just kind of grasp the holistic, and good and bad, then you kind of even out. Everything just kind of equilibrates.
Perfect. Well, we might have to leave it there. I'd love to talk more. I always want to talk more and more to you, Jared. Like, we've got so much we could dive deep with. So, again, we'll probably see you back on here in another little while. But thank you so much for your time today. That was really awesome. I know that people are going to be loving that parenting stuff and the memory stuff. That really, really was awesome information. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Deeply
appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jared.
You're a legend.
Lots of love.
See you, John.
We'll definitely do it again.
Yeah, definitely.
If you found this information inspiring, make sure you subscribe and tune in to the next Dorothy and the Dealer podcast.